welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be interviewing the author of a new book called Generation Roe. There's a chance that family physicians will stop getting proper training in contraception in some programs, and a Lifetime reality show demonstrates the dangers facing girls with virginity-obsessed parents. President Obama addressed Planned Parenthood in a charming 12-minute speech at their national conference. Here's a tiny bit for a taster.
Somewhere there's a woman who just received a new lease on life because of a screening that you provided that helped catch her cancer in time. Somewhere there's a woman who's breathing easier today because of the support and counseling she got at her local Planned Parenthood health clinic. Somewhere there's a young woman starting a career who, because of you, is able to decide for herself when she wants to start a family. One in five women in this country has turned to Planned Parenthood for health care. One in five.
He assured the crowd that even though right-wing attacks on Planned Parenthood have escalated, he will do his best to defend the organization and its work. While most of the focus in the reproductive health debates is on specialists such as gynecologists and particularly family planning clinics and abortion clinics, there's a huge swath of American women that actually get much of their reproductive health care from another source, family practitioners. Unfortunately, while the demand for contraception care from these kinds of general doctors hasn't gone away, there might be a decline in the availability of well-trained family doctors who know how to prescribe contraception correctly, because the American Academy of Family Physicians is considering removing a requirement from their training standards requiring students to learn how to prescribe contraception. NPR did a report.
And for the majority of women, particularly outside major cities, it's family doctors, not obstetrician gynecologists, who provide for their reproductive health needs.
The main people who staff community health centers, as well as large swaths of rural America, are family doctors.
Prine, who's also the medical director of a group called the Reproductive Health Access Project, helped lead a push several years ago to require all family medicine doctors in training to learn to provide all forms of prescription contraceptives.
Getting that training into the program was a big victory for women's health, and now there's a lot of concerns that it might be going away, much to the dismay of women's health advocates who fear that it's already hard enough for women to get the reproductive care that they need under the current circumstances. Because of the political ugliness as of late, it's tempting to assume that the Academy is cracking under some anti-choice pressure. But as far as I can tell, that's not really the case. It's more a mundane attempt to make things a little easier, in no small part because the doctors they're training are so badly needed, and anything that's perceived as an obstacle to getting more doctors certified is being considered for the chopping block.
The feedback we've gotten over the years is that a lot of the curricular requirements were too specific.
Peter Carrick is a professor of family medicine at the Medical University of South Carolina. He also chairs the committee that's rewriting the requirements for family medicine residents. The new rules are to take effect starting next summer.
And so, in general, what we've tried to do as a committee is to, in at least as many areas as we could, pull back some of those specific requirements and give them, more general requirements to follow.
So, nothing sinister going on here. One group we can largely rely on to be supportive of contraception and abortion care is people running this medical association or that. Besides outside of the ideologically right-wing ones, most of them are focused on what's best for patients and what scientists say. And in both cases, the answer is more and better access to the tools to control their fertility. Indeed, if it were just a matter of patient care and science, then loosening these restrictions up would be no big deal, because training programs would offer them as a matter of course. Unfortunately, in the real world, right-wing politics and religious fundamentalism keep getting involved.
But Linda Prine says the big problem with leaving contraceptive training up to each program is that many residency programs these days are run by religious hospitals that don't believe in contraception.
The way it works right now is the residency is required to at least send the residents off-site to another place, say a family planning clinic, where they can learn how to provide birth control. If these regulations change and there's no wording whatsoever about the need to provide contraception, the residency programs would no longer be obliged to send their residents somewhere where they would get this education.
This is where the sinister stuff comes in. As NPR reports, 11 out of 25 of the largest health systems in the U.S. are Catholic-run, and I'm guessing they're going to be happy to cut contraception training wherever they can. The only thing keeping them from doing that is the training requirements. If this weren't a nasty, politicized issue, I would have no problem with the Academy streamlining and minimizing their requirements, since getting more good doctors out the door and into communities is the priority. But the anti-choice pressure on the health system level makes that not a good idea. The comment session is closed now, but hopefully the American Academy of Family Physicians will do the right thing and keep these requirements. I'd like to welcome Sarah Erdrich to the program. Sarah is a pro-choice activist and the author of a new book called Generation Roe, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. She's here to talk to us about her book and, well, the future of the pro-choice movement. Welcome to RealityCast, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you wrote this book to demystify abortion, but let's start by demystifying the title. Who is Generation Roe?
What I think of as Generation Roe are those of us that were born in 1973 or later, so who were able to grow up with legal abortion and kind of our perspective on where abortion and reproductive rights in society.
And how do you think we, I mean, I'm obviously one of them, differ from people that were born before Roe?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of myself in this. I was born in 1977. I grew up in a very liberal area of the country where, for me, the fact that abortion was legal was really not a big deal. It was something that I had the luxury of taking for granted. And I think that is very different than my mother's generation, her mother's generation, and so forth. The flip side of that, though, I would say, is that even though we've had the luxury of many of us of taking this for granted, we've also seen very vividly that legalizing abortion did not settle the question by any means. So we've really grown up, especially those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s as I did, we've seen how violently people can oppose abortion. We've seen the links that anti-abortion and anti-choice protesters will go to. And we've also seen some really significant court cases that have, in a lot of areas of this country, made abortion legal in name only. So I think that's given us a very different perspective, perhaps than people would have expected when Roe was decided back in 1973.
Yeah, that's like one of the things that's always been interesting to me, because on one hand, you have people often claiming that those of us who grew up with legal abortion don't understand how bad it was. Yeah. On the flip side, you often have a lot of pundits saying that if Roe hadn't happened, this would have been resolved without all the controversy. So clearly, you know, those are incompatible points of view. Either abortion is something we can take for granted, or it's something we understand as super controversial, but it can't be both.
Exactly. And I think, though, and again, this is coming kind of from my own personal experience, I think that there is kind of a maybe an assumption that it can be both. You know, I think that, like I said, a lot of us who have grown up in areas, and at times when abortion is legal, we can say, oh yes, we know it's controversial, but that doesn't really affect us. You know, so I think there is a little bit of a distancing that happens as well.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, I grew up in rural Texas, so like the notion that you had to drive hours to get an abortion should you need one has never been alien to me. So obviously you don't think that young women, quote unquote young women, I mean, you know, the first wave of us was 40, take abortion for granted. Not really, though, right?
I don't think so. I think that a lot of us, both women and men, have been in situations where they've had to think about what they would do in the case of an unplanned pregnancy, or in the case of a pregnancy that couldn't be continued for whatever reason. So no, I don't think that we do take it for granted.
You know, there was a period of time where there was like a lot of media stories where you would have people say that young women take abortion for granted and, you know, where are the young women and they don't care, you know, these kind of laments. Sometimes even major activist groups would be on the record saying that. But that seems to have faded away in recent years. I haven't seen a story claiming young women don't care about abortion in like at least 3 or 4 years. Why do you think that has been?
I think part of it really has been the use of social media and social networks to unite people around these issues of not just abortion, but of reproductive justice and reproductive health. You know, I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to technology. So for me, it was very eye-opening when I was doing research for my book to look at all these really great, vibrant communities, either kind of blogger networks or just people, you know, starting their own websites. I'm thinking of things like One in Three or blogs like The Abortioneers that really give people an outlet to meet other people and talk about these issues in a way that I think is, you know, I think for a lot of people it's very intimidating and very difficult to talk about issues around abortion. You know, you're talking about sexuality and religion and family. And I think that there is something kind of comforting in being able to have these conversations online where you can think about what you're saying, you can read other people's perspectives and kind of have a little bit of a, I think it can be a little bit less confrontational in a way in which having a conversation with someone one-on-one maybe isn't. So I think that's really been, and that's just one aspect, I think, of what's been happening. But I think that that's really where younger people have been able to build really strong communities that do filter out into, you know, the real world, for lack of a better term. I think that having those websites, having these avenues really do help people kind of think about how to integrate these issues into their own life, how to talk about them with people in their lives, and can really have a positive and noticeable impact elsewhere.
So let's talk a little bit about the content of your book. When you say that you wish to demystify abortion, what do you mean?
One thing that I am perpetually surprised by, even though I shouldn't be anymore, is just how stigmatized abortion is in our society. You know, the fact, just how poorly represented abortion as a realistic and relatable common choice, how rarely we see that in our popular culture, how difficult it is, like I said, for people to talk about, to have real conversations about abortion that aren't just rhetoric. And I think that that's a real shame. I think that we've seen with a lot of other social issues that being able to destigmatize these issues and talk about them really leads to greater tolerance and greater empathy. And I think there's so many misconceptions around abortion, even by people who would consider themselves pro-choice. I think that really, it's frankly to me, is very shocking.
So why do you think that is? Like, why is it so stigmatized? I mean, it's certainly not because, I really don't think it's because people think it's, you know, baby killing, even though that's what a lot of anti-choicers say. Well, why do you think that is?
I think it's because, you know, abortion, it touches on, it's kind of a very neat nexus for a lot of issues, because you're talking about women's sexuality, which our country, our society, has never been all that great about talking about realistically. It's also, when you talk about abortion, very often, of course, it's talking about issues of family. It's talking about, in a lot of cases, economics are a part of the conversation, education, career, all these really complex issues that people have very strong opinions on. And I think there's kind of a reluctance to bring these issues up for fear that you don't know how the other person's going to react. Even if you personally don't think abortion is, there's anything wrong with it, or you're, you know, incredibly pro-choice, I think there's almost like a reflexive, ooh, I don't know, I don't want to have like an awkward conversation. And that might be simplifying, it might be kind of a simplistic answer to your question, but you know, I think that there is a real hesitancy just on kind of a day-to-day level to talk about issues that could, we don't know how the other person's going to react about issues this controversial, I should say. And that, you know, it has a circular effect that the less that things are talked about, the bigger a deal they seem in our heads, even if that's not really the case.
So when things are kind of circular like that, I feel like what needs to happen is a sort of wrench-like maneuver needs to be thrown into the whole thing, into the whole vicious cycle. What kind of wrench do you imagine would be the one that we need to throw?
I would love to see more discussions about the importance of abortion as part of this continuum of reproductive health, because legal abortion is on the same continuum as legal and accessible contraception, as all these other health issues. I would really like to see it discussed more in our media and in our popular culture than it has been. And I know that obviously it's not the answer to everything, but in our society, for better or worse, popular culture really does have the ability to move the needle on social issues. You look at how, you know, in 1994, 93, I think it was, when the movie Philadelphia came out, about Tom Hanks as an HIV-positive man. And that was so controversial. And that was, what, maybe 20 years ago? And now that movie looks like a time capsule almost, the way that a gay relationship was portrayed on screen. So I think that we've seen with LGBT issues, you know, just to name one, we've seen that having a diverse range of representation in our popular culture really does help broaden people's ideas, and it can spark conversations in a less threatening manner than just kind of bringing these up without being able to say, oh, I saw this interesting show on TV last night. So I know that that's kind of a big answer to your question, and I'll be the first to admit I'm not quite sure how to make that happen, but I think that that would really be a great start.
My guest today has been Sarah Erdrich, and the book is called Generation Roe, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. It's available online and at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Sarah.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. I got love for you if you were born.
I was only recently alerted to the existence of a new reality TV series on Lifetime called Preacher's Daughters, a show that follows around three families of evangelical preachers and how their obsession with controlling female sexuality harms their daughters specifically. I watched the most recent episode, the seventh of the series, and even though you may know intellectually how much fundamentalist Christianity teaches that women are the property of their fathers until they're transferred into the hands of their husbands, their new owners, it's still hard to hear men express those attitudes so easily. Like Mark, the father of Olivia, who is upset because his 18-year-old daughter Olivia wants to, gasp, go hang out with her older sister in Los Angeles for a weekend.
As Olivia plans to go to Los Angeles, you can't help but have some old, you know, pain from having your trust violated come up.
Olivia got pregnant as a teenager, which is no big surprise when you grow up in a culture that shames you so much about your sexuality that it makes actually planning for sex and using contraception nearly impossible. Instead of letting his daughter's sad story cause anything like introspection, however, Mark simply characterizes it as a betrayal, as if Olivia's body belongs to him and by having sex, she took away something that was his. Now it seems she walks around having to live as some kind of embodiment of female sinfulness instead of as a full human being who deserved better than to be stuck at age 18 with very little idea of what to do with herself. Olivia's rebellious urges are somewhat buried under her still lingering sense that she somehow owes her father something. Another girl, Taylor, seems to be waking up a little more to how unfairly her parents treat her. It starts when her parents discover photos on Facebook where she was mugging for the camera. It's all very adolescent and innocent, but because she's trying to look a little sexy, they flip out and decide to punish her by making her go through purity classes again.
So obviously, you need to go to class again.
Taylor has gone through this Passion and Purity class before, where we teach our young ladies and our young men how to keep themselves pure and holy to the Lord without having sex. She needs to go through it again to regroup and to recommit herself. I think she needs to take it all over again. All right?
All right.
After completing the class, the young ladies make their vows and receive their promise ring unto the Lord at the father-daughter dance. To see Taylor recommit her vow is very important to me. It's going to be a wonderful time, and I can't wait. All right, get out my face. I want to see you right now.
I can't believe that just because I'm in some stupid pictures, my dad is making me go to the Passion and Purity class again. They're overreacting.
Taylor is only 16, but she's starting to see how ridiculous all this is. Upon hearing that her virginity pledge is supposed to make not just her vagina her father's property, but her lips as well, she freaks out and starts to complain, correctly, that this is all completely ridiculous. At 16, it's easy enough to say you're not going to have sex, but being told that you can't even kiss somebody? That really drives home how unfair and ridiculous this all is.
Untouched is up there talking about how you should be pure, but then she started talking about you can't kiss before marriage. The way they're talking is like, I'm cheating on Jesus if I kiss a guy before. And I've been cheating on Jesus this whole time and didn't even know it.
The show makes it really clear what's going on here. The parents are exploiting their children's dependence on them and love for them to extract promises that the girls will eventually break. And should break because their parents are wrong to demand ownership over the girls' sexualities. But when it's your parents, it's really hard to handle how incredibly unfair they're being to you. It's nearly impossible, in fact, to face up to the fact that they are using your love for them as leverage to try to control you and to make you feel guilty when you invariably decide to have sex on your own schedule instead of the one they wrote for you. Taylor is still young, but she's already seen serious flaws in what her father demands of her.
I'll take this vow, and I want to, you know, take it seriously. It's like no point of just taking it for no apparent reason, because that's just bogus.
It's better not to make a vow than make one and break it.
Exactly. Thank you. That's why she made no vow.
Taylor made me do it.
No, because I'm saying, you never know what the future holds, and I don't want to be feeling like this worst person if I didn't keep it. It already says it in the Bible, do not commit fornication. So why we got to go through this extra stuff with it? I'm not going to lie to God. It's important to me not to be lying to him, because I know kissing, I'm probably going to break that the next day.
It's a shame she's made to feel badly when this situation is 100% her father's fault for trying to exert control over what does not belong to him, which is his daughter's life and his daughter's body. That's what I kept thinking over and over again watching this show. How unnecessary all this is. None of this strife between parents and daughters is necessary if the parents let go of the illusion that they are the owners of their daughter's bodies. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Pat Robertson telling Crazy Lies Again edition. This time he told this whopper about Margaret Sanger.
She was the one who set the stage for Adolf Hitler. He didn't, she didn't copy him, he copied her. Planned Parenthood, it's unbelievable how evil they were in the early days.
The only thing that Planned Parenthood in its early days had in common with the Nazis is that neither of them supported abortion rights. But that's not what I suspect Pat Robertson is getting at. Obviously, Sanger's organization came around on the abortion issue, but in the early days, they did oppose abortion. Robertson isn't even making the usual facetious comparison of abortion and genocide. He's actually comparing contraception, which is what they offered then, and genocide. Because, yes, anti-choicers are out to get your birth control.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.